And so for me, this is very personal, I think, in the sense that my idea of what the darkness looks like is not some abstract thing for me. And I'm not telling myself that it couldn't happen. I think a lot of people just have this mechanism where they sort of rationalize, or they sort of equivocate and they go, yeah, but it's probably not going to be that bad. You know, I think that's just a knee-jerk reaction that a lot of people have, that I just, for some whatever reason, I don't have that reaction. I just go, oh, well, it really could get that bad, so let's make sure it doesn't. You know, like, I've heard the stories, I wasn't there, but I don't want to live through it. So let's try and prevent it. Yeah.
Hope Punk is a podcast about choosing hope in the face of adversity. Hope, meant as an activating force, not wishful thinking. The term was originally coined by fantasy author Alexandra Rowland, who in 2017 wrote a Tumblr post simply stating, "The opposite of grimdark is hope punk. Pass it on." Now, grimdark is a particularly dystopian subgenre of science fiction, and hope punk doesn't negate that dystopia exists, but it says, in the face of it, choose hope anyway. In a world that is unkind, just being kind in itself is a radical act. And while some would want to make us believe otherwise, hope punk is everywhere. That's why it is my intention with this podcast to shine a light on the people, projects, and spaces that embody hope-inspired action every day. What is the meaning of hope for us personally, in the face of illness or loss, for instance? And given the current state of the world, how does hope, or the lack thereof, shape our politics and society? My guest today is Omri Price. Omri is Managing Director at Alliance for Europe, a nonprofit we co-founded in 2018 in light of the rise of anti-democratic populist movements all across Europe ahead of the European elections of 2019. Since then, he and the team have grown the organization into a relevant player in the European democracy space. He is one of those people who work tirelessly to make Europe more democratic and accountable to its citizens. He holds a master's degree in European policy and has a track record working in EU affairs and civil society. He's worked in the European Parliament and for human rights and sustainability organizations on campaigning and advocacy. Omri embodies hope punk to me because he works tirelessly for positive change in light of the many challenges European democracy is faced with. He has a deep understanding of the threats facing democracy in Europe and understands the faults of the system of the EU, but he doesn't give up on the European idea. On the contrary, he also focuses on what is going right and works within the existing political system to make things better. Thank you very much for being here, Omri.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
What's your take on hope?
What's my take on hope? That's a good question. I think hope is a motivator. You need to, as a living organism that needs to, you know, find light and food and sustenance and all that, you need to be able to tell yourself that that thing that you're looking for is coming, right? If you look for it. So it's, I think hope is one of the most fundamental things that we can have as humans, one of the most fundamental things that you need as a motivator or as a living thing, that you will be able to shape the reality that you want to live in, that you need to live in, that you will be able to go out there into the world and get what you need from it. And from that sort of very biological need also comes, you know, all the visions and stories and beliefs that we have as individuals and as a society, to think that, as you said in your introduction, yes, there are dark things out there and there are terrible things that happen in the world and there are lots of things that we should be very worried about. But if we do what we need to do in the face of that, if we take action, then we can achieve and we can shape a better reality. So hope, I think, is not some kind of naive just opinion or view or expectation. I think that's not it, or at least it's not a very useful aspect of it. The more useful and relevant and necessary side of hope, or the kind of hope that I'm talking about, is the motivation to go out and make things better, to have maybe a vision of what that better thing looks like and then going out to get it. And it's kind of like, you know, if to go back to the animal analogy, you know, if you're a deer out in the forest or a bear or a wolf or whatever, and you go, I really need that juicy next meal, whether you're a herbivore or a carnivore, you tell yourself, okay, I'm going to go and get it. You know, I need to go and get that thing that I need. And with human beings being more sophisticated in how we view things, I mean, there is this famous speech of Martin Luther King, "I have a dream," that Marshall Gans from Harvard, who's done a lot of narrative development work, also talks about the fact that the there's not just a dream in that speech, there's also a nightmare. So going from that dark, grim place, the danger, the thing that we're trying to avoid to get out of, to then have a dream to go towards, you know, what is that sort of image of the better world that we want to live in? So to me, hope is wanting to be aware of and avoid that nightmare scenario in order to take action and build the scenario that we want to live in, a better world.
Thank you very much. We met in 2018 during one of the first general assemblies of the political movement Volt Europa, and ended up later that year co-founding Alliance for Europe. And I think one of the things we connected over was that feeling of, you know, Europe could go either way, could either turn into this vision that I believe that we share of a democratic, pluralistic Europe as it is laid out in the treaties, or it could slide into authoritarianism. So how does your vision of hope, like how does your understanding of hope feed into the work that you now do with Alliance for Europe? What exactly does Alliance do, and how does your understanding of hope feed into your work there?
Again, a good question and some things to unpack. And indeed, when we met, I think a lot of people woke up to exactly this scenario of we're sliding towards authoritarianism and populism and this reality that we don't want to live in. And in a way, we use these big words, but you know what I've also figured out more and more over time is that we should use really like very blunt and sort of unlaundered and unacademic words. I mean, authoritarianism means that someone comes and takes your freedom away. It means that you don't have a choice on what you want to do with your life. It means that you don't have the agency to make make your own life better, or to determine the lives of your children. Or that, you know, someone comes in an unmarked van and just takes you away. Like, that's what authoritarianism really means. And when we talk about populism, we're really talking about people lying, people just manipulating you in order to, you know, develop these kind of cults, these cult political bodies that then put a leader in charge who can then oppress other people. So we're talking about this in kind of in academic words, but making it really visceral for people, I think, is important. And with Alliance for Europe, what we recognize is that if we want to live in a prosperous, successful, democratic Europe where everyone has freedom and opportunity and all those nice things, and we want to avoid this situation of a dictator taking everybody's freedom away, we need people to be active. We need people to stand up. We need people to go out to vote. We need people to participate in campaigns that shape the public agenda. And so we set up the organization, as you mentioned, to really drive voter turnout and to connect up all different parts of society to work together, whether it's nonprofit organizations or media or academia or business, to kind of join up strategically to be able to turn out Europeans to vote. And then as we developed, we saw that there is quite a lot of this whole of society approach, as it's called, to bring together. So on the one side of the organization, we work on what do the bad guys do, right? It actually connects to that grim, dark versus hope punk.
Bad guys in this case being enemies of democracy.
Yeah, enemies of democracy, which, you know, they're very conscious, very calculated enemies of democracy. It's not a coincidence. They really do believe what they believe. So, you know, we're talking about the Russian government. We're talking a bunch about other authoritarian governments like North Korea, Iran, China, etc. We're talking about oligarchs that are affiliated with these. We're talking about the MAGA dark enlightenment movement. You know, that the dark enlightenment basically is a tech bro term for bringing back medieval times, basically. And these guys run influence operations. You know, the Russian government has this entire infrastructure of different disinformation campaigns known to people who work in the field as influence operations, where they have a vast infrastructure, fake accounts, fake websites, bot farms, troll farms, different ways of manipulating algorithms, different channels and influencers and you know, consultancy firms that are based here and there and everywhere. And what we do is we bring together open source intelligence analysts and researchers, civil society, journalists, academics, etc. We expose these, and then we see how can we break these up? How can we block them off? So that we look for the tactical vulnerabilities, we look at their infrastructure, we look at EU sanction enforcement, we look at the Digital Services Act, which is a piece of EU legislation which is very important in defending all of our rights. And so on and so forth. So this is one side of the organization, which we call the red side, the red team, because we look at what the bad guys do. It's kind of security type thinking. Then on the other hand, we have the blue team, the side where we empower the good guys, so to speak, or guys and girls, of course. So the blue machine looks at how do we connect and empower campaigners? How do we enable these democracy defenders to be more effective so that we bring together advocacy and lobbying efforts on behalf of European civil society, on behalf of business that is mission aligned, on behalf of all of these groups to have more impact so that we mobilize people to turn out and vote in elections, so that we run campaigns that are civil society campaigns and then whole of society campaigns to really define the agenda. So there is this mirror of, you know, getting away from the bad, from the nightmare, and towards the hope, towards the dream. We recognize that in order to manifest hope, we really need that whole of society approach, right? We need the different parts of society working together. And that's why we have this broad mandate, but we are a strategic connector. We bring together networks for impact. That's what we do at the core.
When you say bringing together networks for impact, I mean, a lot of the time, I think civil society is mentioned as this sector that is not influential, that is somehow vested interest, kind of, you know, public debate. It seems like sometimes the framing is such. But I think the two of us know that, you know, civil society is actually a key player in European democracy. And mm-hmm. you have, with Alliance for Europe, also been involved in networking a lot of civil society actors from all across Europe to work on very concrete projects. Would you perhaps want to tell us a little bit more about one of those networks? For instance, the Democratic Tech Alliance or whatever you would like.
Sure. So, yeah, I think there are quite a few different misconceptions, maybe. I mean, when we're talking about like civil society, it can mean different things, right? So basically, when people get active, they want to get involved in campaigning, whether it's at your neighborhood level or the national level or European level, you know, like civil society in a way is a term for active citizenship, right? On the one hand. On the other hand, we're also just talking about the non-profit sector. So Alliance for Europe, we're a not-for-profit company, a GGMBH. For the German listeners, we're registered in Germany. We have non-profit status. We work with a lot of other organizations that are non-profits. And when we talk about civil society, in that sense, we're basically talking about non-profits a lot of the time, right? And in a way, you know, there is this big public narrative about lobbying in Brussels, right? The big tech lobby and all these corporate lobbies and so on that do exercise a lot of power and influence. But the nonprofit lobby, it's not much advertised that it actually has a massive amount of impact at a fraction of the cost. So, you know, big tech is spending hundreds of millions of euros, literally hundreds of millions, on shaping the agenda, whether it's Google, which is, you know, a very, very large scale lobbyist operation, Meta, and all the big ones, you know, like just think of a company, they're there. Civil society will often have, you know, nonprofits will often be running campaigns that are, you know, at a fraction of the price, so tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of euros, and they will beat hands down. We have, you know, gotten points across that big tech cannot, or you know, that big tech has their impact with lots of money. We have a lot of impact with a lot less money, and we managed to shape the agenda massively. And I'm not just talking about Alliance for Europe, but about the sector. So I think when a lot of people kind of despair and go, oh, well, you know, the whole thing is bought by the corporate lobbies, like, no, you can make a huge amount of difference by being at the right place at the right time with the right expertise, with the right information. And also there is a premium on being one of the good guys and girls, so to speak, because, you know, a lot of politicians are there for the right reasons, and they do want the pro-European agenda. They do want, you know, European tech sovereignty. They do want, AI that doesn't abuse their children. And when you're there with a solution, they do want to listen to you. So it's not magic. It's about human work and human effort, but it does really work. So then when we get to something like the Democratic Tech Alliance, we really are talking about a really interesting convergence of different actors, you know, coming together, is something that we've set up with partners at the European Parliament. And actually next week we have this Democratic Tech Alliance Assembly in Brussels, where we've brought together businesses, you know, European small and medium-sized enterprises, some major companies have participated, a lot of nonprofit organizations, the Commons Network, Alliance for Europe as well, of course, and quite a few others, coming together with media organizations, with academia, think tanks, and together with members of the European Parliament from across the democratic political groups. So everyone from the Christian Democrats, so-called EPP in the European Parliament, that's the biggest family, biggest grouping, let's say, the center-right. You have the Social Democrats, where, you know, that name is familiar, on the center-left. You have the Liberals, so-called Renew Europe. You have the Greens, and those are like the main four democratic groups. And we have MEPs represented from all of those. And the idea is really to shape the agenda for Europe's tech future. So we're talking about the tech sovereignty package that is, you know, coming out soon, published by the Commission. There is, you know, a lot on cloud infrastructure, for example. There is a lot on how to enforce the Digital Services Act and how to defend democracy with the EU Democracy Shield. There is the EU budget, the multi-annual financial framework. It has a fantastically long and attractive name, but that is a huge amount of money that the EU will be spending in the next 7 years. And how does that strengthen our digital democracy? That's extremely important. And by bringing together all of these really important elements across decision makers with all of these stakeholders shaping an agenda together, we can really act together. You know, we can really build the majorities that can then win votes and give also national leaders at the next stage, right? So when you get out of Brussels and you get to like the national leaders having to make a decision on these things, also hopefully we can build up the political capital for those decisions to be made, you know?
Yeah, because I think it's also important to understand that, you know, a lot of what is happening in Brussels is obviously, as it is intended in the entire European project, is very closely tied to what is happening at the national level. Yeah. It's not like it's not this rogue space that
exactly
is,
and I know. Think especially if you know, we were talking about like who might be listening to this podcast, I think that, you know, if you just sort of you don't work in politics but you watch the news and you're kind of following what happens politically, it often sounds like in the national news as if you have Brussels and then you have, you know, the national governments are sort of far removed or something. But actually, that's not really how it is. You know, all of the national governments are continuously represented and working day in, day out through the embassies here in Brussels, or what's called the permanent representations. And so the governments are constantly working at developing these common positions, right? So you have this constant exchange within the Brussels ecosystem, but also with the national level, constantly putting this this policy together. And our challenge is to engage not just the people in Brussels, but the people at the different capitals, so Paris, Berlin, Vilnius, Rome, you know, Copenhagen, etc. There's a lot of them. That's a challenge, and it's one of those less appreciated elements of European politics, let's say.
One of the conversations we had ahead of this conversation, as you said, one of the things that gives you hope is that integrity is a choice. There are a lot of people going into politics that have not just, you know, individual interests, but actually interests of a European democracy at heart. Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think that this is, again, something that with us, you know, with Alliance for Europe doing certain amounts of advocacy and lobbying and agenda setting, convening partners and so on, you see the mechanics of how decisions are taken is also something that I brought with me in the experience of working previously in the European Parliament. So seeing these things close up. And often in the public perception, there's this view that lobbying happens in some kind of like fairy dust. You know, politicians come in, you know, some lobbyist comes in and sprinkles some fairy dust on them and boom, like suddenly some corporate lobby has gotten, you know, some great benefit. But actually, a lot of it is just a very democratic need for information, right? So if you're a decision maker that, you know, has a speech in 1 hour or needs to submit amendments to a law by, you know, X deadline, you just need to know stuff that you might not find out. You know, you're sitting in your office, you don't know all that much about the world that isn't happening in your office, right? So like any of us.
And it's not just enough to just Google.
Yeah,
right?
It's a very human thing, right? All of us are kind of sitting where we are, and you see what you have out of your window, so to speak. And a lot of the time, you just need that information, you need that input, and that's the basis that lobbying and advocacy is based on at the most fundamental level. Now, a lot of politicians and a lot of public officials genuinely do want to do well in their job, right? They do actually believe and work on the values that they have. It's not all doom and gloom out there and all sort of like a sellout territory like we often kind of imagine if you just read the news. And, you know, having worked in politics and in this kind of advocacy, I've seen again and again is that indeed it is a choice. Integrity is a choice. You know, when you come in as a politician or as a public official and you have your room to maneuver, what you want to represent and what you want to pursue at the end of the day comes down to your own sense of, you know, what you want to see in the mirror when you wake up in the morning. Like,
same that, goes, obviously, for representatives of civil society organizations.
Yeah,
right?
the same goes to representatives of civil society organizations, of course. It goes to any one of us. But I think that it's sort of an underappreciated fact when we look at politics and we see all the scandals out there, and especially now we have, you know, much more colorful and more odious characters that are unfortunately in the headlines all the time. And some of them are the color orange. But anyway, I think it's easy to kind of lose track of this fact that this is all human. And a lot of the time, you know, when I've worked in Brussels, I've helped certain groups come in for meetings, you know, whether, you know, civil society, nonprofit groups, or like even school kids that come to visit from out of town, you know, when you're working in the European Parliament. And people are surprised, you know, once you do get into the meeting. I was like, oh, I didn't realize it would be that easy to like just go to the commission and have a meeting with them. And it's like, well, yeah, it's just people doing things, you know, and a lot of the time, people have good intentions, and a lot of the time they want to do a good job and they're looking for the information. And whether they want to serve some kind of corporate interest or whether they want to follow what they think is right based on some moral compass is really just their choice. You know, like there is not some kind of magic that makes it happen. And if people choose to do the bad, the less good, that's often a choice. And there are obviously different worldviews as well, if you want to get more political about it. You know, some people do believe that deregulating is how to achieve
a
better goal.
All and black
some
and
people
white, good, bad
yeah,
kind of
like
thing,
a
right?
lot of people so... will yeah, exactly. Like but what you see with something like the Democratic Tech Alliance and the approach that Alliance for Europe wants to take is that, you know, we're not partisan, so in terms of we're not party political, we want to have that conversation with people that are willing to have a genuine conversation about it. So we will have people from further to the right who will genuinely believe like big corporates are the way to go. I believe that we should enable them to scale. I believe that we should deregulate, etc., etc. And then you will have someone who's maybe in the Greens or, you know, on the like further left of the Social Democrats kind of saying, no, I don't think we should look at these business models. I think we should look at smaller collaborative type business models, or, you know, emphasize open source. And yes, we need these regulations, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can have a meaningful debate about it, right? And you can bring in academia, you can bring in media, you can bring in businesses that actually have an interest and have a stake but are playing by the rules, and you can have a really interesting conversation. But once you have actors that don't accept the rules of the game in a democracy, or maybe are
gaming the system,
zigzagging through for whichever interests, then obviously it becomes less productive to have that conversation. But yeah,
I think it's worth at this point noting how Alliance for Europe, you know, going back to the beginnings of Alliance for Europe, making that point that it is nonpartisan. You know, we were 25 co-founders. We came from all over the EU, all over Europe. Some of us had founded civil society organizations before. Others had worked in, as you know, as you have, in the European Parliament and for human rights organizations and such. Others had a business background, and you know, by no means were all of us politically aligned. But one thing we did agree on, and where we did see a need to shape this new organization that became Alliance for Europe, and which you have been at the helm of for the past 8 years, was the fact that we need to. Yeah, I know. Is that we need to safeguard democracy as a space. Try to protect the public space in which democracy takes place.
Yeah, and we almost really didn't even try to align politically in any kind of partisan way, right? Because, you know, we basically didn't even need to go through that, because everyone just agreed on the fundamentals. And you know, with Sonia, who was, you know, the director before me, she always said, you know, this is Article 2 of the Treaty on the European Union, which is basically the line where it says the union is organized around these values of democracy, human rights, the rule of law,
pluralism
rule of law. And tolerance, and the rights of minority and equality between men and women. That's like, I read the text recently, so I have it fresh in my head. But anyway, so these fundamental, like, these are fundamental values. And I think in a way, the reality of being attacked by autocrats and dictators, in it creates a large tent politically, but it also shrinks the type of things that you need to agree on, right? Because in order to oppose Putin or oppose Trump, you don't need to agree on the nitty-gritty of market regulation, or to agree on the nitty-gritty of specific policy areas. You need to agree that, you know, freedom and democracy are required in order to have a prosperous society.
And to have these nitty-gritty discussions in the first place.
Exactly, exactly. So then you create a big tent by reducing the number of things that you need to agree on. And that's where also, you know, there's sort of a method to that of then also being able to bring in more actors that have different kinds of capacity for different things, right? So you have nonprofits, you have communicators, you have researchers, you have different types of people who all have a role to play in that value chain of democratic action.
You know, using Hope Punk as a frame, sort of, you know, the science fiction background, you know, it's easy to talk about the good guys and the bad guys, but, you know, it's messy in reality. And Hope Punk is also all about being messy, and hope being messy, hope being something that you can activate in dark times, that can be activated in dark times, particularly then. Mm-hmm. And how far would you say it's fair to say that we are actually at this point where it is democracy versus authoritarianism? Like, is that what we're talking about here? Are we not there yet?
My answer is yes, a categorical yes. I would recommend some books that help put this into perspective,
which I will link in the show notes.
I mean, I agree that the world is messy, and that in terms of the general public and people's opinions, there are lots of people who have less tolerant, more tolerant views of the world, and they have maybe legitimate grievances of all kinds, right? So what I'm trying to say is not to generalize about people who have opinions in the public sphere. There are people in very powerful positions who do not think that democracy is a good idea, and they are fighting a real hybrid war against the freedoms and the things that we hold dear. And this is Vladimir Putin and his regime. That's one very dominant and powerful player here. And then you have all of the types of, they call themselves illiberal, you know, as a kind of a cover. I hate that word because it is
the illiberal democracy, the Orban type.
It's the Orban type, but it's basically a view of a way of making a mess of the discussion.
Viktor Orban,
thankfully the former prime minister of Hungary. But I mean, illiberal just means a dictator style oligarchy with some nuances, right? So you don't fully become a complete dictator, but you kind of put enough of your friends in power that like no one can remove you. But the result is eventually the same. And you have, you know, the MAGA Americanized version of this Russian autocracy is Peter Thiel going around talking about the Antichrist. I mean, I recommend just listening to an hour of Peter Thiel on a podcast. You just put his name into Spotify, listen for as long as you can bear it. I don't know if you can bear it, but like, it's madness, you know. It's very intellectually incoherent, but it is very sprawling. Like, he really does think things, you know, the formula doesn't quite add up, but
he
is
basically
there.
Says and, freedom and democracy. What does he say? Democracy he is incompatible says, with
so,
freedom.
Something so yeah, so lines. Democracy has become incompatible with human progress and with real freedom. I think it's important to understand that there is a real force out there, and they really do have things that they believe, which entails, you know, taking away our freedoms is what it really comes down to. And as Elon Musk tweeted when he got fined by the European Commission, and then Medvedev, the former prime minister, current national security chair of Russia, he Elon Musk said the EU should be dismantled and power should be handed back to the national states. Pretty much that formulation in that sentence. And Medvedev tweeted back, "I agree." And that basically shows you kind of where we're at. There is a really good book by Timothy Snyder, who's one of the best kind of thinkers on this in the world today. The name of the book is The Road to Unfreedom. And what he does in that book is he really illustrates how Putin's current regime is connected with early 20th century white Russian fascism. So there were these fascist philosophers that were reading Mussolini in the early 20s. They wrote books about how Mussolini's fascism should apply to Russia in the view of like the whites, the Tsarist Russians, taking back control from the Bolsheviks. And this fascist Russian thinking tumbling through the ages, you know, he goes through the whole lineage of it. But that really informs Putin's thinking now, where Putin sees that, you know, the Soviet Union was this great Russian empire in the tradition of great Russian imperialism that is connected to the Russian Orthodox Church, where Russia has this divine role in the world to be, you know, it was, you know, Jerusalem, Rome, and Moscow. That kind of triangle. It is up to Moscow to protect these Christian nationalist values, and on and on it goes, on it goes. And obviously, as part of all of that, Putin and the oligarchs can take all of the wealth of the state and steal all the money they can. That's the Russian side of it. On the MAGA side of it, you have, if you go back to Ayn Rand, a philosopher who was, you know, had some interesting things to say.
Shrugged.
Yeah, exactly. Originally, a Jewish American woman who wrote some books about the power of the individual and how the individual, the hero, this kind of very talented people should shape the world by just being extremely talented and extremely selfish. You know, that we are born alone, we die alone, and, you know, society and history is shaped by these really powerful, amazing people who just have all the capacity, and they should just go out and be themselves, be great. You know, society should basically serve these great people, and you should just go out and be a Randian hero. And that thinking had a massive amount of traction in the 80s and 90s and 2000s with the whole sort of like financial services industry and Silicon Valley and all of this sort of Reagan neoliberalism that morphed and morphed and morphed, kind of Wolf of Wall Street and kind of the whole startup boom and this kind of captains of industry thing. And it has morphed and merged with this science fiction thinking, which again connects to the theme of this podcast, where you have all of these visions, you know, of people like Elon Musk, people like Peter Thiel, and others that want to go to Mars, that want to have an intergalactic species and whatever.
Colonize
space and all of that. And what Peter Thiel says, he basically says, look, I've seen the movies, and it's 2026 now. We're supposed to have flying cars and flying skateboards and lasers and shit, but we don't. Like, what do we have instead? Like, all of these smartphones and things that are much less interesting than spaceships. And why is that? It's because we've degenerated. We have decomposed as a society. We are no longer achieving man on the moon kind of moments. We're achieving like the new iPhone. Why is that? Because of woke. We've focused not on the great overachieving man, but we've focused on empowering all the weaklings and all the terrible people, like, you know, women and this and minorities and how people
feminism
feel
is responsible
and blah,
for
blah,
this,
blah,
etc.
And so, yeah, and I'm paraphrasing him, right?
Yeah,
so
of course.
These, like, I just want to me, this is just a regeneration of a type of Nazism, basically. So we've stagnated, we've stopped achieving things, and this stagnation, hold your breath, is the Antichrist, right? And in order to combat the Antichrist, we need to overthrow democracy, overthrow woke culture and political correctness and all of these things, and actually, you know, go back to this idea of this great historical Übermensch.
Thank you for bringing up these connections, because I think it goes back also to another important point of scholars describing these movements, right, that are sometimes hard to grasp. Like what you just described feels so out of, you know, so sci-fi and so a lot of the times so unreal. But there are some very smart people looking at this also academically, you know, Karen Howe. She is a very renowned journalist. She wrote a book called Empire of AI. And I know she also spoke in the European Parliament a few weeks back. You were in a hearing with her. There's also another article that I will also link in the show notes by Timnit Gebru, who wrote an article along with other researchers about the so-called Tesk Real Bundle, which elaborates on what you just described. But basically, going back to this sci-fi element of this, because a discussion in European politics for a long time has been Europe needs a narrative, right? And I think hope punk or just futures-oriented thinking is about imagination, about opening up spaces for possibilities, about imagining positive visions or from our perspective, positive visions of what the future could look like. And a lot of this thinking of the Peter Thiels and the Elon Musks, but also Sam Altman's, and, you know, is this inevitability paradigm right now that is trying to tell us that there's only one way to think progress. Yeah. And there's an inevitable path towards a dystopian kind of future. So how do we reopen that space towards positive visions of what society can look like? Do you know what I'm trying to ask?
Yeah, I know what you're trying to say, and I think it's a really big and important question. And again, Peter Thiel has just been like one very bizarre and very kind of outstanding exponent here. But I mean, we could also talk about Bannon and his thinking and some of the others. So, you know,
Let's not.
But like we can, we don't have to. It's all kind of shades of different types of extremism and so on. But I think that we need to be able to call bullshit on a lot of this. There is another book that I wanted to recommend that is called Autocracy Inc. by Anne Applebaum, which is a great book. And her work is also, I think, really fundamental to understanding a lot of this. And she really outlines how this is all like a business model. It's a grift, basically. All of these like big ideas that we're talking about, at the end of the day, it's being used in order to make money for these people, whether it's Putin and his oligarchs, Orban and his oligarchs, Netanyahu and his cronies, Trump and his cronies, like it's a grift. And the religion and religiosity and the sci-fi and the mysticism and the ideology, a lot of it is a cover for this Autocracy Inc. business model, which makes money. Now, to get to your question of how do we open up the future on this, a lot of it is just calling bullshit and basically saying, thank you very much, but no thank you. And not getting lost, I think we liberals and we Democrats, wherever we are on the democratic spectrum, we have academic degrees, we like to get into interesting intellectual discussions. We like to be right intellectually about the points that we're trying to make. That's the thing that sort of makes us tick. And it's the thing that
don't
we're
know what
also,
you're talking about.
We're trained to do it, you know, because we're people that, you know, have gone through school, we're used to exams and writing papers and proving our point and being right. And we need to let go of that, right? We need to think much more in terms of how do we gain power and how do we exercise power?
Power and or influence? Or is that
both.
The same thing?
Power and influence. Because we need power in order to secure our freedom and to design a better world, right? And so that's one side of it in terms of what the democratic movement, camp, etc. needs to do is and that's also what Alliance for Europe tries to do when we decide strategically where to deploy. Where are the buttons that we need to push in order to win the struggle for this point or that point? Where is the power leverage? And that's where we try to mobilize and to make the most difference that we can. And once we have liberated ourselves by calling bullshit and saying, thank you very much, Mr. Trump, Mr. Thiel, etc. We recognize that for what it is. We can then talk about the future on our own terms, right? We want a free, inclusive society where, you know, women are free as people in society to have equal rights and all of those things. We do not want the ethnicity or the color of skin or religion or sexuality and gender orientation to determine what a person is in their life, right? We want freedom not just for, you know, rich white men, but for other people too. And we know what that freedom looks like because, you know, you go to a good gay pride parade, you know, it's a great liberating moment for a lot of people. You go to a lot of, you know, festivals out there or, you know, you think about any of the cultural moments of a liberal democracy nowadays, you know, a Glastonbury festival, whatever, you know, like that's the kind of, you know, free
World
society.
Cup.
Well, I mean, the World Cup has been, you know, also kind of bought over, but
that's
like.
That's true.
But I mean, I think that you can think of the kind of economic opportunity that you want people to have so that, you know, you can buy a house, you can start a family, you can afford to do those things, you can be better off than your parents were, which is something that is no longer the case for future generations. So, you know, like we need to be able to produce these visions on our own terms and to then try and also design the technology and the political processes and so on that enable this to happen, right? So if we want an inclusive society, we don't need to apologize for what has been labeled woke, whatever, you know? Like we need to think about how to make that messaging more effective because maybe progressives have not been as effective communicating that set of values, which sort of enabled the far right to come in and poke holes at it. And progressives maybe haven't focused their energies in the most productive ways around this. But we shouldn't kind of say, oh, yeah, we woke is now passé. And now, you know, like now it's fine to be a misogynist again. Okay, you know, I can make inappropriate jokes, whatever. Which kind of, you know, for a little while after the Trump re-election, sort of that felt like what was happening. Whereas we need to kind of define our future on our own terms and our stories on our own terms. And the way to open up is to kind of clean up the windshield from some of the crap that we are seeing out there and really focus in on what we find valuable.
Yeah, I feel it's also about something about redefining strength, right? I feel like it's not just being better than the other or on top of the other, but actually I think that we are probably aligned on the idea that strong democratic pluralistic societies make for strong democracies, which make for stronger mandates, which make for stronger you know, just stronger nations within a stronger EU.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, absolutely. And
this not being a contradiction, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that, I mean, Ukraine and the fight for freedom that Ukrainians have been incredibly courageously waging in the last four and a bit years now really illustrates this. It really illustrates that, you know, what you have at stake, right? What does it mean to have a dictatorship invade and try to take over your country? What does it mean to have a free society that is meritocratic and can actually resist and can innovate, and where people are not, you know, people are motivated to fight for something? And of course, fighting a war is extremely, extremely brutal and difficult. And, you know, like, you know, I don't want to kind of oversimplify it or something, but like, you do see that you have a free people that is innovative, that is resourceful, that can find out how to fight. And on the other hand, you have this brutal dictatorship that is like a machine just sort of grinding people down.
And it keeps going back to the point you made in the beginning. It's about, yeah, you know, kidnapped children. It's about killings. It's about
it's dark.
Grimdark,
yeah, it's
things.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of, I mean, I sort of, whenever I come in contact with that, I mean, one of the things when the war started, you know, every so often I try and reconnect it to some of the work that we've done with Alliance for Europe, because, you know, just to kind of thread the needle a bit, and you've also, because you've asked me to, but you know, in 2022, when the war started, we provided some kind of immediate support in helping to kind of helping civil society organizations
to evacuate.
Yeah, with our colleague Maya, like basically helping to evacuate some children from the front lines and vulnerable people, like at the very start of the war. And then onwards, you know, speaking to Ukrainian partners and colleagues, also the ones that are working in the kind of information integrity type of work. And I just feel very humbled, I think, every time you you have this kind of more abstract discussion about how do we define our future, how do we, you know, all of these kinds of things, and then you have a people that really is kind of experiencing this very viscerally excruciating struggle, which is just, you know, concretely on their doorstep. So yeah, it does remind you what is at stake, and I think the kind of hope that Ukrainians have been able to generate, I've found really inspiring, to say, you know, yes, there is this war, we're fighting it, but hey, we're innovating. You know, you talk to Ukrainian tech innovators and they're like, yeah, we're going, like, yeah, it's happening, we're doing stuff. It's really like a no holds bar sort of drive, and that's hope as well, I think, for me.
Yeah, also they're living their lives, they're celebrating birthdays, right? Raising children, as you say, innovating. I don't know whether you would be willing to answer this question before we wrap up, but in how far is this personal for you?
How far is it personal for me? Yeah, it is personal for me. I mean, obviously it's professional in the sense that this is kind of what I've decided to do in my day job. And I think with Alliance for Europe, you know, really working to counter this kind of rising autocracy day in, day out, is just something that I think is really important to do, and someone should do it. So that's, you know, kind of what I found myself doing, because that's basically been me trying to see and say to myself, okay, what's the most important thing that I could do right now? And if I wasn't doing it, I'd be kicking myself, right? I'd be like, someone should do it, so I might as well, right? But yeah, like, we have a lot of really exciting and interesting people that we work with. You know, we have this network of more than, you know, 110 organizations, 450 people or so in the network, working to counter these influence operations, so the counter disinformation network, where that's how a lot of this infrastructure of how these autocrats manipulate the information space gets exposed and gets broken up. And that's a very sort of technical description, but at the same time, you know, I see that by doing these things, I'm also trying to protect my own life, you know, trying to protect the life that I want my family, my community to be living, right? And it's a very practical thing for me in the sense that, you know, having come from a family where my grandparents went through the Second World War, kind of that, and survived that, and growing up with that not being a piece of history, but being something that's very real and kind of in daily life. And then growing up in a reality, being a child in Israel, where you have war not as a distant thing, but as a thing that's sort of an ongoing presence, you really understand what the stakes are. Because I think for a lot of Europeans, there is no, West Europeans at least, maybe for like the kind of former communist places, it's different. But for West Europeans who are used to freedom and used to peace, it's kind of hard to see how that could go away, right? Like if I speak to Dutch friends, British friends, wherever, they don't quite imagine, you know, they say, yeah, but I don't think it could ever really get that bad, you know? And it's like, you don't have any control about how bad it gets once it starts getting that bad, you know? Like once you've kind of broken through the security barriers and you're sort of tumbling, you've kind of gone over the rails down the hill, you don't know how bad it's going to get, you know? So you might as well not get there. And so for me, this is very personal, I think, in the sense that my idea of how, like, what the darkness looks like is not some abstract thing for me. And I'm not telling myself that it couldn't happen. I think a lot of people just have this mechanism where they sort of rationalize, or they sort of equivocate and they go, yeah, but it's probably not going to be that bad. You know, I think that's just a knee-jerk reaction that a lot of people have, that I just, for some whatever reason, I don't have that reaction. I just go, oh, well, it really could get that bad, so let's make sure it doesn't. You know, like I've heard the stories, I wasn't there, but I don't want to live through it, so let's try and prevent it. Yeah. So it's kind of, I think it's personal for me on that level, you know?
Which makes it very personal.
Yeah, I guess so. So yeah, that's
one of the reasons why I think that you are Hope Punk, really, because you don't look away, right? You see the potential for darkness, having mm-hmm. known what it could look like in your family and beyond, and you try to, you know, knowing that there are things that aren't going right, but you know, you never give up on trying to change things for the better. So.
Yeah, and maybe I think that together with hope, there is this word that we maybe haven't mentioned, but I think there is a lot of opportunity, right? Because we do have something that we want to avoid, but at the same time, that means that we need to take action, we need to do stuff, and that means that we need to create opportunities. And opportunities make you better off, you know? It means that you can build a bigger house, get the things you wanted, like have the relationships you wanted, live, laugh, love, you know, whatever, you know, like
sounds
all of
like
the
progress,
all of that, you know, all of those things that, like, I mean, it's a bit cliche, whatever, because we're so used to these like American election campaigns and Hollywood movies and whatever. But in reality, people want to have a good life where they can spend time with their family, where they can spend time on things that they want to do, where they, you know, you can go on a hiking trip to the Andes or the Himalayas, and you can, you know, sit down and read a book if you want to. And at the end of the day, I think that with hope comes opportunity, and we can really define and grab the opportunities that are, you know, before us. So it's not just darkness. I think there is a lot of light there too. And for me, that's also personal, because I feel like, you know, building a better life starts here, you know?
Absolutely. Is there anything else you would like to say to the cynics or the critics out there anything that you haven't so far?
The cynics and the critics, I think that there is a lot of work that really does have an impact, even though it's a big picture out there. People could say, yeah, but these are such big problems and how could you really solve them? I think just walking into the room, or, you know, like with the researchers that we work with, like just doing some open source research and finding out, you know, how these networks work and just very, very practically kind of getting your hands dirty, so to speak, that already achieves a lot, you know. So just kind of saying, oh, it's a big problem, how do we solve it? You know, that doesn't cut it. Like, you can really do a lot if you step in and do it. And there's no reason to be naive, but just being cynical is a luxury that we don't have, right? So you can sit back and go, yeah, but how are you going to do all of that? And my, well, human nature is always terrible and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, yes, that's all well and good. But the imperative that we have is, what do we do about it, right? So you can be a cynic, you can be a critic and whatever, but unless you want to go live in a nuclear bunker in New Zealand, you know, on the other side of the world, you need to figure out what you're going to practically do about it, because you do not have the luxury of not doing anything about it. And that's, I think, the thing that people also don't realize is, yes, everyone needs to pay the rent. Yes, everyone has things they need to worry about in their day-to-day lives. But these issues will impact all of us, and what you do about it in your own life will be your problem, whether you recognize it or not. So you have a responsibility towards this, no matter who you are. Yeah.
Word.
Yeah.
That brings me to my final question, Omri. If you were just, you know, finishing school today, you were like 18 or 20 years old in 2026, which advice would you give yourself?
Yeah, finishing. So there's a difference between, you know, I finished high school. I'm going to date myself here. I finished high school in 2006. So that's exactly 20 years ago. There is a difference between graduating in 2006 and 2026. The world is quite a bit different. I think that the advice that I would give that wouldn't maybe be cheesy is to understand the value of growing assets. I don't know, it sounds like a strange thing to say, but like, you put your work and effort into something and you make it grow in value, like build things that matter and help them grow. And I think that's kind of what we have tried to do and what we've done in a way with Alliance for Europe. And it's what a lot of successful business people who build companies understand, you know, like you have an asset and you try to grow the value of it. But I think as a young person, it takes you a while to get that logic, because you kind of are used to just doing stuff and making stuff work and so on. But I think there is, you know, one of the powers that we have as humans living in a community is we assign value to things, and we build the tools, and then we kind of make these institutions grow. So like now with Alliance for Europe, we started out just as an idea. Now we have a brand, we have a network, we have things that we've really developed. We've had methodologies and all of this stuff. And you don't want to be doing things over and over again at the same level, right? You could build a ditch with a shovel, or you can get a bulldozer and build that ditch more effectively, or you could, you know, drive over to the next town and, you know, rent an army of bulldozers and set up a construction site. You know, you can like leverage a loan from a bank to get a construction company going. So you see, like, you have these different exponential ways of doing things. So I think, I'm sorry if I gave you too much of a complicated answer to the question, but I think that if there was one thing that I would actually tell a young person graduating, whether it's me or someone else, is to try and build up value. And that you could also be creative and make art and write songs and then publish them and, you know, put them out into the world, and they gain value that way. But it's just thinking in that way of creation and value making is I think a really important thing that sometimes it's hard. You can be just idealistic and forget about it or not realize it, you know? So I would try and give that advice. Maybe it makes me sound a bit old. I don't know.
No, it's wonderful. The last person I had on the podcast, Thomas Coombs, he described himself as a gardener. It's also about making things grow.
I'm glad he was here. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Omri.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
That was Omri Price, Managing Director of Alliance for Europe. Omri sees hope as a motivator and working towards a more desirable future. In the context of his work, that means defending and strengthening democracy in Europe, which is increasingly under threat, and working to make our societies more resilient. Omri is not naive. He takes nightmare scenarios very seriously. But in light of these, he dedicates himself to pursuing the dream of a democratic Europe that lives up to its values. These values, ones that the European Union was founded upon, are laid out in Article 2 of the Treaty on European Union. I quote, "The Union is founded on the values of respect for human dignity, freedom, democracy, equality, the rule of law, and respect for human rights, including the rights of persons belonging to minorities. These values are common to the member states in a society in which pluralism, non-discrimination, tolerance, justice, solidarity and equality between women and men prevail. Is the EU living up to these values? Certainly not. It's always been imperfect and continues to be so. But it's the best answer anyone could come up with to ensure peaceful coexistence after the continent was ravaged by two world wars. And every attack on these values, every time we question whether women and men should be treated equally, for instance, is a direct attack on the foundation of the European Union itself. For European democracy to survive and to thrive, Omri says, and I would agree, that we need people to be active, to go out and vote, to organize around issues they care about. And importantly, we need an environment in which people are free to do so without fear from repercussion. Threats to the system are manifold, and Alliance for Europe contributes to addressing them via their red and blue teams, and in tandem with their many partners. Their funding may be limited, but their work is impactful. Check the show notes to find out more. Thank you for listening to today's episode of this podcast. My name is Maite Schomburg, and I look forward to welcoming you again next time. Goodbye.